My feelings were all for the unfortunate mother. It is a weakness of mine that I so often lament, that I take upon myself the cares and sorrows of every unfortunate that crosses my path. It would be easier to have a harder heart and a more cynical turn of mind. As always, when I am saddened or distressed, I reached for my brush and scroll and began to record all that was taking place around me. Everything from the harpooners, the bereaved mother, the skinning and the butchery of the dead river cows and crocodiles on the beach, to the unfettered behaviour of the feasting, revelling populace. Already those who were stuffed with meat and gorged with beer were snoring where they had fallen, oblivious of being kicked and trampled by the others, still capable of remaining upright. The younger and more shameless were dancing and embracing and using the gathering darkness and the inadequate cover of the scanty bushes and the trampled papyrus beds to screen their blatant copulations. This wanton behaviour was merely a symptom of the malaise that afflicted the entire land. It would not have been thus if only there had been a strong pharaoh and a moral and upright administration in the nome of Greater Thebes. The common people take their example from those above them. Although I disapproved most strongly of it all, still I recorded it faithfully. Thus an hour sped away while I sat cross-legged and totally absorbed upon the poop deck of the Breath of Horace, scribbling and sketching. The sun sank and seemed to quench itself in the great river, leaving a coppery sheen on the water and a smoky glow in the western sky, as though it had set fire to the papyrus beds. The crowds on the beach were becoming ever more raucous and unrestrained. The harlots were doing a brisk trade. I watched a plump and matronly love priestess, wearing the distinctive blue amulet of her calling upon her forehead, led a skinny sailor who was half her size from one of the galleys into the shadows beyond the firelight. There she dropped her skirts and fell to her knees in the dust, presenting him with a quivering pair of monumental buttocks. With a happy cry, the little fellow was upon her like a dog on a bitch, and within seconds she was yapping as loudly as he was. I began to sketch their antics, but the light faded swiftly, and I was forced to quit for the day. As I set my scroll aside, I realized with a start that I had not seen my mistress since before the incident with the dead child. I leapt to my feet in a panic. How could I have been so remiss? My mistress had been strictly raised, I had seen to that. She was a good and moral child, fully aware of the duties and obligations which law and custom placed upon her. She was aware also of the honour of the high family to which she belonged, and of her place in society. What was more, she stood in as much awe as I did of her father's authority and temper. Of course I trusted her. I trusted her as much as I would have trusted any other strong-willed young creature in the first flush of passionate womanhood on a night such as this, alone somewhere in the darkness with the handsome and equally passionate young soldier with whom she was totally infatuated. My panic was not so much of the fragile maidenhead of my mistress, that ethereal talisman which once lost is seldom mourned, as for the much more substantial risk of damage to my own skin. On the morrow we would return to Karnak and the palace of my lord Intef, where there would be wagging tongues aplenty to carry the tale of any lapse or indiscretion on any of our parts to him. My lord's spies permeated every layer of society and every corner of our land, from the docks and the fields to the palace of Pharaoh itself. They were even more numerous than my own, for he had more money to pay his agents, although many of them served both of us impartially, and our networks interlocked at many levels. If Lostris had disgraced us all, father, family, and me her tutor and guardian, then my lord Intef would know of it by morning, and so would I. I ran from one end of the ship to the other, searching for her. I climbed into the stern tower and scanned the beach in desperation. I could see nothing of her or Turnus, and my worst fears were encouraged. Where to search for them in this mad night I could not begin to think. I caught myself wringing my hands in an agony of frustration and stopped myself immediately. I am always at pains to avoid any appearance of effeminacy. I do so abhor those obese, mincing, posturing creatures who have suffered the same mutilation as I have. I always try to conduct myself like a man rather than a eunuch. I controlled myself with an effort and assumed the same coldly determined mien that I had seen on Tanos' features in the heat of battle, whereupon my wits were restored to me and I became rational once again. I considered how my mistress was likely to behave. Of course I knew her intimately, After all, I had studied her for 14 years. I realized that she was much too fastidious and conscious of her noble rank brazenly to mingle with the drunken, uncouth throng upon the beach, or to creep away into the bushes to play the beast with two backs, as I had watched the sailor and the fat old harlot do. I knew that I could call upon no one else to assist me in my search, for that would have guaranteed that my Lord Intef would hear all about it. I had to do it all myself. To what secret place had Lostris allowed herself to be carried away? Like most young girls of her age, she was enchanted with the idea of romantic love. I doubted that she'd ever seriously considered the more earthy aspects of the physical act, despite the best efforts of those two little black sluts of hers to enlighten her. She had not even displayed any great deal of interest in the mechanics of the business when I had attempted, as was my duty, to warn her, at least sufficiently, to protect her from herself. I realized then that I must look for her in some place that would live up to her sentimental expectations of love. If there had been a cabin on the Breath of Horus, I would have hurried to it. But our river galleys are small, utilitarian fighting ships, stripped down for speed and maneuverability. The crew sleep on the bare deck, while even the captain and his officers have only a reed awning for a night shelter. This was not rigged at the moment, and so there was no place aboard where they could be hiding. Karnak and the palace were half a day's travel away. The slaves were only now erecting our tents on one of the small inshore islands that had been set aside to give our party privacy from the common herd of humanity. It was remiss of the slaves to be so tardy, but they had been caught up in the festivities. In the torchlight I could see that a few of them were more than a little unsteady on their feet as they struggled with the guy ropes. They had not yet erected Lostri's personal tent, so the luxurious comforts of carpets and embroidered hangings and down-filled mattresses and linen sheets were not available to the lovers. So where, then, might they be? At that moment a soft yellow glow of torchlight further out on the lagoon caught my attention. Immediately my intuition was aroused. I realized that given my mistress's connections with the goddess Happy, her temple on its picturesque little granite island in the middle of the lagoon would be exactly the place that would draw Lostris irresistibly. I searched the beach for some means of reaching the island. Although there were shoals of small craft drawn up on the shore, the ferrymen were mostly falling down drunk. Then I spotted Kratas on the beach. The ostrich feathers on his helmet stood high above the heads of the crowd, and his proud bearing marked him out. "Kratas!" I yelled at him, and he looked across at me and waved. Kratas was Tanos' chief lieutenant, and apart from myself, the firmest of his multitude of friends. I could trust Kratas as I dared trust no other. "Get me a boat!" I screamed at him. "Any boat!" I was so distraught, and my tone so shrill, that it carried clearly to him. It was typical of the man that he wasted not a moment in question or indecision. He strode to the nearest felucca on the shore. The ferryman was lying like a log in his own bilges. Kratas took him by the scruff of the neck and lifted him out bodily. He dropped him on the beach, and the ferryman never moved, but lay in a stupor of cheap wine, twisted in the attitude that Kratas had dumped him in. Kratas launched the craft himself, and with a few thrusts of the punt pole, laid alongside the Breath of Horus. In my haste I tumbled from the tower and landed in a heap in the bows of the tiny craft. "To the temple, Kratas," I pleaded with him as I scrambled up, "and may the sweet goddess Happy grant we are not already too late." With the evening breeze in the lateen sail, we were whisked across the dark waters to the stone jetty below the temple. Kratas secured the painter to one of the mooring rings, and made as if to follow me ashore, but I stopped him. "For Tanis' sake, not mine," I told him. "Do not follow me, please." He hesitated a moment and then nodded. "I will be listening for your call." He drew his sword and offered it to me, hilt first. "Will you need this?" I shook my head. "It's not that kind of danger. Besides, I have my dagger, but thank you for your trust." I left him in the boat and hurried up the granite steps to the entrance of the temple Happy. The rush torches in their brackets on the tall entrance pillars threw a ruddy, wavering light that seemed to bring to life the bas-relief carvings on the walls and make them dance. The goddess Happy is one of my favourites. Strictly speaking, she is neither god nor goddess, but a strange, bearded, hermaphroditic creature, possessed of both a massive penis and an equally cavernous vagina, and bounteous breasts that give milk to all. She is the deification of the Nile and the goddess of the harvest. The two kingdoms of Egypt and all the peoples in them depend utterly upon her and the periodic flooding of the great river, which is her alter ego. She is able to change her gender, or, like many of the other gods of this very Egypt, take on the shape of any animal at will. Her favourite guise is that of the hippopotamus. Despite the god's ambiguous sexuality, my mistress Lostres always considered her to be female, and so do I. The priests of Happy may differ from us on this view. Her images upon the stone walls were vast and motherly. Painted in hectic primary colours of red and yellow and blue, she beamed down with the head of a kindly river cow and seemed to invite all of nature to be fruitful and to multiply. The implied invitation was most inappropriate to my present anxiety. It was my fear that my precious charge might even at this moment be availing herself of the goddess's indulgence. A priestess was kneeling at the side altar, and I ran to her, seized her by the hem of her cape, and tugged at it urgently. "Holy sister, tell me, have you seen the Lady Lostres, daughter of the Grand Vizier?" There were very few citizens of Upper Egypt who did not know my mistress by sight. They all loved her for her beauty, her gay spirit, and her sweet disposition, and they clustered around her and cheered her in the streets and marketplaces when she walked abroad. The priestess grinned at me, all wrinkled and toothless, and she laid one bony finger on the side of her nose with such a sly and knowing expression that all my worst fears were confirmed. I shook her again, but less gently. "Where is she, revered old mother? I beseech you, speak." But instead she wagged her head and rolled her eyes towards the portals of the inner sanctum. I sped across the granite flags, my heart outrunning my frantic feet. But even in my distress I wondered at the boldness of my mistress. Although as a member of the high nobility she had right of access to the Holy of Holies, was there another in all of Egypt who would have the nerve to choose such a place for her love tryst? At the entrance to the sanctum I paused. My instinct had been right. There they were, the two of them, just as I had dreaded. I was so obsessed by my own certainty of what was taking place that I almost yelled aloud to them to stop it. Then I checked myself. My mistress was fully clad, more so than was usual, for her breasts were covered, and she had spread a blue woolen shawl over her head. She was kneeling before the gigantic statue of Happy. The goddess beamed down upon her, bedecked in wreaths of blue water lilies. Tanis knelt beside her. He had laid aside his weapons and his armour. They were piled at the door of the sanctuary. He was dressed only in a linen shift and a short tunic, with sandals on his feet. The young couple were holding hands, and their faces were almost touching as they whispered solemnly together. My base suspicions were refuted, and I was struck with remorse and shame. How could I ever have doubted my mistress? Quietly I began to withdraw, although I would go only as far as the side altar, where I would give thanks to the goddess for her protection, and from where I could keep a discreet eye on further proceedings. However, at that moment, Lostres rose to her feet and diffidently approached the statue of the goddess. I was so enthralled by her girlish grace that I lingered a moment longer to watch her. From around her neck she unclasped the lapis lazuli figurine of the goddess which I had made for her. I realized with a pang that she was about to offer it as a sacrifice. That jewel had been crafted with all my love for her, and I hated to see it leave her throat. Lostres stood on tiptoe to hang it on the idol's neck. Then she knelt and kissed the stone foot while Tanis watched, still kneeling where she had left him.